The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast.
That's true.
Any of the fire content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything.
Unless you're abusing people, then I have a problem maligning you.
Also, we're not doctors, psychologists, or wizards. We're just two non-experts trying to make you a friendly, informative podcast that helps you understand culty shit. Hey, everybody. Sarah Edmondson here.
And I'm Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy, Sarah's husband. And you're listening to
A Little Bit Culty,
a.k.a. ALBC, a podcast about what happens when devotion goes to the dark side.
We've been there and back again. A little about us. True story. We met and fell in love in a cult. And then we woke up and got the hell out of Dodge.
And the whole thing was captured in the HBO docuseries The Vow, now in its second season.
I also wrote about our experience in my memoir, Scarred, the true story of how I escaped NXIVM, the cult that bound my life.
Look at us, a couple of married podcasters who just happen to have a weekly date night where we interview experts and advocates in things like cult awareness and mind control.
Wait. This does not count toward date night, babe. We got to schedule that. That's separate.
So it's 2 days we got to hang out?
We do this podcast thing because we learned a lot on our exit ramp out of NXIVM, still on that journey, and we want to pay the lessons forward with the help of other cult survivors and whistleblowers.
We know all too well that culty things happen. It happens to people every day across every walk of life. So join us each week to tackle these culty dynamics, everywhere from online dating to megachurches and multi-level marketing.
This stuff really is everywhere. The cultiverse just keeps on expanding, and so are we. Welcome to Season 5 of A Little Bit Culty, serving cult content and word salads weekly on your favorite podcast platforms. Learn more at alittlebitculty.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of A Little Bit Culty, the final mashup in a series of 5 mashups.
We're just mashing over here, mashing it up. This one's actually quite timely because it comes on the heels of Masterson's sentencing, and this one has a justice ring to it. No, Sarah?
It's all about it, and which is rare in these cases. I think why everyone in the survivor cult recovery space is talking about and really noticing the difference in what is happening in the court systems. Can you summarize what happened to Danny Masterson, who is a Scientologist, for those who might be unaware?
The summary is, as I understand it, he got sentenced to, I think, 30 years to life for raping, I believe, 3 people over 20 years ago.
Convicted of 2, I believe, though.
Okay.
Yeah, I think.
And I believe Scientology had a hand in silencing the victims because they were Scientologists. So basically, there's an ecosystem of abuse within Scientology that silenced these women and protected Danny Masterson. So this is another gut punch. And I think Leah Remini is someone we can thank for this to the Church of Scientology.
And also go to her page if you want to know more about it. She's very vocal.
Yeah, she's spending her own money. She's a true force and an example, I think, for everyone who's, you know, pursuing justice and how to do it. So she's one of our personal heroes, she and Mike Rinder.
Also, if you've been following the Lori Vallow case, she was found guilty of murdering her 2 children. And if you don't know anything about that story, it is absolutely heartbreaking, and that can be covered in more depth in our episode called Murder, Faith, and End Times with Leah Sottile on Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell, which is a fascinating book about the whole prepper meets extreme Mormonism meets delusions of grandeur and many other things. So yeah, I feel like things are shifting.
Or at least people are being educated more on what it looks like, which is great, which is prevention.
Yes.
Dealing with the aftermath. But let's dig into the main course, shall we, Sarah?
Yes. This is our second NXIVM extravaganza. We hope you liked last week's episode with Mark in India and Susan and Karen. Reminder, we will be back soon with all new episodes. Until then, you can always hang out with us on Patreon at patreon.com/alittlebitculty if you are just craving some fresh, culty content. But for this mashup,
Keith Raniere's trial was at the center of the Vallow season two, and this episode is taking you even further into the courtroom circus. We're featuring insights from three people who had a close look as anyone could get.
First, you'll hear from our personal hero, Moira Kimpenza, the prosecutor who brought Keith Raniere to justice. Her accomplishments are mighty, like Keith's conviction on all counts, including racketeering, sex trafficking, and a brisk 120-year sentence. Moira's groundbreaking approach to the case has been credited with paving the way for other sex trafficking prosecutions against powerful individuals. In other words, she's a total badass. In this episode, Moira sits down with us to talk about what it's like to take on a world-class dirtbag, our wording, not hers, and what really chaps her ass about NXIVM's Voldemort.
More about today's guest, Moira is now in private practice as a litigator and a partner at Wilkinson Stutcloff. Crane's New York business named her in the 40 under 40 list. She's been ranked as one of Bloomberg's Law's 40 under 40, and her legal analysis has been featured in the New York Times, CNN, ABC, NPR, and Daily Beast.
Next, you'll hear from Robert Gavin. Robert has been a news reporter for 28 years, also having worked for 2 years as an editor. Originally from Staten Island, Gavin began his career by covering the New York City police and fire departments, the NYS Capitol, state and federal courts, various murder trials, and cases involving terrorism, mafia, street gangs, and political corruption. And eventually, Robert's role in the NXIVM trials and their coverage would play a crucial part in bringing down Keith Raniere.
Finally, you'll hear from Vanessa Grigoriadis, who is an award-winning long-form journalist and podcaster, having published profiles on the likes of Karl Lagerfeld, Lady Gaga, and Arianna Huffington. So how'd she get tied up in NXIVM's bullshit while also reporting on the cult? Well, the short answer is, anyone and everyone is susceptible to coercive control and persuasion, even members of the press. The long answer? I guess you're just going to have to listen to find out.
If you enjoyed this episode and missed the longer version, please go back to seasons 1 and 2 and 3 and find the full version if you were feeling like you just wanted to know more. Until then, here is our NXIVM medley, part 2. For the listeners who don't know you and your role in our lives and the NXIVM trial, would you mind just bringing us back to the moment when, like, you're living your life and you read the New York Times article and that, or whatever started your journey with us?
Sure. So I was going to say, you really were right there at the beginning of the journey, Sarah. So it was just reading the New York Times, which I do every day. I'm a lifelong New Yorker. And front page was this story about you. And I was immediately drawn in, as I think so many other people were. And for a number of reasons, I mean, we were right at a moment in time where people were starting to really talk about abuses of power. I went to school in upstate New York. I went to undergrad at Binghamton. I did law school at Cornell. So that was something that was very interesting. But I think in particular to me, what stood out was that I immediately thought there is more to this story and that there's potential criminal activity here. Being a federal prosecutor at that point in time, I was in a position where I was able to react to that in a way that, you know, thankfully we got a great team together and we were able to ultimately put together this case. But it was really starting out just seeing what you had said had happened to you, hearing what Catherine and Mark were saying in that initial article, and just immediately trying to learn more. So one of the first things that I did after reading that article was basically get on the internet and try to learn everything I could, because in some ways it was shocking that I had never heard about this before, given how many people had gone through NXIVM classes, given the fact that there had been this investigative reporting many years before that had uncovered a lot of wrongdoing and what looked like criminal activity. I was really surprised that I had never heard of this. And so immediately start digging in, see all of the websites for Keith Raniere, for all of these sister companies, for all of these various individuals. And it was just all of a sudden, I was truly down the rabbit hole. And just to be clear, like, I know that you have talked about your experience speaking with law enforcement, and you knew that we were going to talk about that today. But normally, I wouldn't talk about my interactions with somebody who spoke to me as part of my job and as part of being a witness without their permission. But I'm doing it kind of in this context and understanding that I have your permission to kind of talk about those initial experiences.
You can talk about anything for me related, like it's all good. Open book at this point.
Great. So one of the first things I did was really try to figure out who was your agent, who are your lawyers. And so I think the first people I spoke to were people who were connected to you as entertainment lawyers, not as, you know, a lawyer representing you in the context of Nexium, the criminal organization. But really sitting down with you, that was one of the first experiences that we really had where we started to learn more about this organization and more about what was happening. And that's really what we did right away. So I read the article. Tanya Hajar, who is the other prosecutor who ended up trying the case with me, she was immediately interested as well. That day, we got this incredible FBI agent, Mike Weniger, assigned to the case, his colleague, Mike Lever, and then Charlie Fontanelli, who was actually New York State Police. And that was huge, too, to have that connection right away. And so we had this team right away that was incredibly invested in this. And so within weeks, we were sending out tons of subpoenas, and we were meeting with witnesses and meeting with survivors, victims. It was so much so quickly. That is not always typical of a law enforcement investigation, because based on what we were learning beyond the New York Times article, we had every reason to believe that there were still women in danger at that point in time, and that there would be continuing criminal activity if Keith Raniere were not stopped.
Wow. I got goosebumps.
I think that's an accurate assessment. I want to go back because you read the article and you have an impression, and you have an impression that there's abuses of power. What was your hypothesis as to what it was, and then compare that to what you learned and what you uncovered? Because I know for me, I knew there were some abuses going on after that, but what you guys uncovered shocked me.
Way more.
So right away, when you were reading the original article, to have the allegations about collateral, right? That sort of coercion, when you hear that, that enables so much criminal activity, right? It's not just in the Nexium context. In so many crimes, what enables it to happen is the ability to have that coercive control over people. Whether, you know, you're talking about the mob, whether you're talking about a street gang, whether you're talking about a drug cartel. Once you have that source of power, you have an amazing ability to victimize people and commit different types of crimes. So that stood out right away. And then, of course, the allegation that Keith Raniere was behind this so-called women's empowerment group is just a shocking thing right at the outset. You know, and I think that was something that throughout the whole case really resonated with people, like this fundamental fraud that you had this man in the background as this puppet master. I wish I could say I was shocked, but I had done a lot of victim-centric cases, a lot of sex crime cases by the time I read the article in the New York Times. So by the time I'm reading about Sarah's experience, I had seen coercive control before. I had seen victims of sexual abuse and really shocking crimes already, you know, and I almost had a reputation in the office, although I hadn't been there that long, as the person who got these quote crazy cases or took on really these quote crazy cases, but they weren't crazy to me, right? It was really, these were the worst crimes that are being perpetuated.
It had the symptoms.
100%. There was part of me that immediately thought there could be a sexual component to this. And that was corroborated, that gut feeling, very quickly, because I met with people who had been assaulted by Keith Raniere and as part of DOS. So I think that was something that happened really quickly. And then I do give enormous credit to the Albany Times Union and what they had been able to uncover all the way back in 2012. A lot of the predicate acts and the background of what I, you know, became kind of this criminal organization that I charged, a lot of that had been identified before. And it was, you know, very troubling, of course, that it hadn't been stopped earlier. But then there was more uncovered. And I really do think it was a matter of really building trust with people, really understanding where people were coming from. You know, I always come back to the agents, but I think their rapport, the fact that we all came to this with a healthy skepticism, but immediately were confronted with real facts that showed that there were crimes here that needed to be prosecuted.
This might be a little earlier than we wanted to ask it, but you said something that has really been my question as this whole thing's unfolded from the beginning, because I was there in 2009 when a lot of these women complained, and I went in and asked everyone, you know, what's going on here? Because I was thinking of getting out or just leaving, not knowing, you know, there's too much here to ask questions to. And I got lied to see that Times Union was actually on the scent and wasn't able to get, you know, the proper investigation or Keith arrested. I felt like if these things were true, then there was a criminal justice system in place that would held him accountable either locally or wherever.
That's actually what Lauren said. She said, if these things were true, he'd be in prison. And I was like, oh, okay.
Obviously, that's the question. And subsequently, since we started our podcast, we've asked a lot of these people why they think these abuses of power have gone on. A lot of them do have protection from certain government agencies through loopholes. And I'm just wondering what you think happened there, or why it was able to exist and quote unquote get away with it. What do you think went on?
Are you allowed to answer that?
Frankly, I can't fully comprehend why law enforcement didn't act earlier. Of course, this is a very complex case, and I came at it in a world in which I had a very dedicated team. I was at the Eastern District of New York, which has a lot of resources, which has a historical practice of prosecuting these really big racketeering cases. So I had all of that on my side, but I do think it's a real question that still remains out there as to why nothing was done earlier. And Judge Garifas raised that during Lauren's sentencing. And I think that was just a powerful moment, because I think all of us, as proud as we are of the resolution that we got in this case and the fact that Keith Raniere isn't able to hurt anyone else, there's still a real sadness. And it really is a tragedy that so many people, including Sarah, including the other women in DOS, they never had to go through that had this been stopped earlier. And so I think that's really one of the things that I think remains a mystery. However, if I were to hypothesize, I think a big factor was the amount of funding and financing that was behind this. And so when you look at the campaign that was initiated just against you after the DOS story was broken inside the organization, where you had someone who's actually able to get on a plane and try and get authorities to act against you, Sarah, and where that has happened in the past successfully, where they have been able to go after critics, where other people have been able to, you know, have essentially prosecutions handed to them in a box. I think that that is something that is a very, is very powerful. And so I think the other thing, though, is that there was just a ton of fear in terms of the people who were victimized, right? Understandably so. I think once DOS happened and once that really blew up and once there were people speaking out, that enabled other people to be part of a group. And there was still an enormous amount of fear, right? Every single witness interview I did, I was, you know, talking people down, explaining the fact that they were protected now, that it was very unlikely that there was going to be any physical violence, that it would be very hard to retaliate at this point in time. But I think until then, people would have been outliers. And first of all, it's hard to build a case if you don't have cooperative witnesses, right? That's pretty fundamental. And then on top of that, you know, people didn't want to say these things happened to me because they didn't believe anyone was going to support them, and they thought their own lives would be ruined instead. And that's the pattern they had seen already.
Sure, that makes sense.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org.
Like most federal trials, if you've covered a lot of federal trials, if there's any federal prosecutors listening, I think they'll know what I'm talking about here. It's almost every single case, the opening statement will be, this is a case about insert your crime. You know, this is a case about greed. This is a case about theft, you know, blah, blah. Wasn't like that with Nexium. Tanya Hajar, who did the opening statement, she really told the story and opened up this world of the three sisters and how they had been all had different experiences within Nexium. They told the story of how basically Keith Raniere had taken advantage of them and branched out from there to talk about the case. And I thought it was a very powerful opening and really showed, you know, people, if you didn't know what this case was about, that's what this case was about. And Keith was sitting there, and every day Keith Raniere had he had a sweater and he had his little tie on. So he had basically a different color of a blue, usually a blue sweater, kind of like this here, and then maybe the tie there. And he looked very preppy. So the pictures you see of Keith Raniere, where he's got the long hair, and I think there's even video of Keith where he refers to himself as looking like a cult leader with long hair. But Keith at trial looked like a college professor, you know, from the 80s.
He's always a few decades behind, isn't he?
I think that's probably true. He had his attorneys there. He had Mark Agnifilo. He had Paul Derenassian. And then there was also two other attorneys who were both women there, and Danielle Smith. But I mean, he had a lot of attorneys. And I think when the trial starts, the very first witness they called was a woman who had been in DOS. I'm not going to say her name because I don't know how open she is about going public, but she had been in DOS.
Married, by the way.
Yes, she was a married woman who had been in DOS, and everybody in that room who had been there, it was clear she did not want to be there.
I was there.
Wait, Nippy, you were there?
I was there for the first 3 days of the trial, and then I left right after the metadata.
Wait, so did you guys meet? Nippy and Rob, did you guys meet?
I think we did, but it was so... I think the second or third day I met you in the park.
Yeah.
I think I passed you in the park outside the courthouse. But there's so many people around. It was crazy, you know? It was a lot of people around. I mean, it was a jam-packed courtroom. Yeah, because I mean, honestly, it wasn't until recently that I even mentioned Daniela, because to me, I didn't want to identify her sister. But now they're all public, so it's kind of like, you know, it was strange for me, the fact that the names were being mentioned. I thought that was kind of weird. Not in court, that people were mentioning it in print. That was unusual.
When she revealed that Keith went down on her and she had to talk about that in trial, I thought, for sure, similarly to how I thought when watching The Vow, and we'll get to this later, that would certainly be the straw that broke the camel's back for people who are still loyal.
Or at the very least, have the appropriate effect on them.
Alas.
It's astounding. There were many points of that trial where you would think anybody hearing it would be like, are you kidding me? Every day, and I think, you know, Nippy knows this from being there, it was like, every moment, every day you'd say, well, that can't get any stranger. And it would get stranger. Like, I remember one day being there and I thought it was going to be a procedural witness. I'm like, this is just going to be a witness to just, you know, lay down some kind of foundation. And it was the guy from, I want to say Excessive Restraints or whatever. I'm probably mispronouncing the name. It was from a California company. And they start showing pictures of dog collars and there's like, you know, chains and, you know, dungeons. And, you know, and we're just looking at each other like, I don't think we can say this on the air, but we're like,
you can say anything. You can let it rip here, Rob. This is not the Times Union podcast.
Okay. I was just like, what the fuck is going on here? You know, it was bizarre. And to put it, you know, mildly, you're just sitting there like, why are we seeing this? And party is like, I don't know if I want to know why we're seeing this, but you know, I could laugh, but it was a very serious thing at being the foundation was being laid for. And that was for when Lauren Salzman would get up there and Lauren would say that she didn't want to be in the cage and be punished for quote unquote indiscretions by Keith Raniere. I mean, what, if you think about it on the surface, like you're like, what part of that sounds good? Like, we're going to put a cage in a strange house here in, you know, Saratoga County, New York, which is going to be our house, you know, and if you do something Keith doesn't want, you're going to be punished. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, you can make the case that Keith seemed to really excel at getting people to do things that they would never want to do. And there's things that have come out of that case that I don't think a lot of people may not be aware of. I mean, including the fact that there was testimony from India Oxenberg that Keith had himself and also directed Allison Mack to use the N-word to a Black woman in DOS. And Michelle Hatchett, which is, you know, racism, and it's just horrendous. But as far as when you hear things in Nexium, it just kind of gets lost in the shuffle, almost like, you know, the quote unquote enemies in Nancy's basement. There's all these parts of this case that are, could just in and of themselves are appalling. But when you hear everything, it's very hard for a lot of it to overshadow other parts of it. But I do think the branding, and I think the fact that people were quote unquote slaves does, I think that's, it did get a lot of attention because it's bizarre. But I think Nippy will support me on this. In court, as bizarre as the case probably sounded to people reading it, it was stranger in person. You know, there was a lot of things there. You know, there's a lot of testimony in court sometimes where you hear someone saying something and they're like, well, you know, we're going to allege this person said this, or, you know, the police officer said that he said this. But in Nexium, we heard Keith saying, so yes, it's alleged, but we heard tape of Keith Raniere telling Allison Mack what he wanted women to say when they were being physically branded. We heard his voice over and over again. So it's a, one of those cases where it's like, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes and ears? That's kind of, I think, why it was so hard for them to mount a defense. I found that as time went on, we did start seeing supporters of Keith Raniere in court. I didn't really know who they were at first. And then more and more they would appear there. And honestly, by the time you get to closing statements, and I could talk about any witness, because there was a lot of the, you know, witnesses were very powerful, especially Daniela, especially, you know, the actress Nicole. I thought Lauren was, I mean, you want to talk about an effective witness. She's about as effective a prosecution witness as I think I've seen in a case like that. As far, and when I say a case like that, because there aren't a lot of cases like Nexium, but in a racketeering case, and I've covered organized crime trials, and it shouldn't be lost on people that at the end of the day, that's what Keith was charged with. And that's what Tanya Hajar and Moira Penza had said during their statements and opening and summation, that he was a crime boss. And you sit there and you go, crime boss? Well, he sits there like he's an intellectual, or as critics might say, pseudo-intellectual. But, you know, that's what he presents himself as. But he's doing things that a crime boss does.
Yeah, that's the con.
When you say that every day was like crazier and crazier, do you have one or two particular moments that were like the craziest, or anything that stands out other than what you shared? Tell us.
There's definitely a few of them that stand out. One of them was when Daniela was talking about, I mean, she was talking about how at a point where Keith Raniere had not been speaking to her for months, had been avoiding her and accusing her of, you know, not doing what she should have been doing. She falls asleep on the couch and she says, he comes in. I mean, well, he hasn't spoken to her in months. Sees her there, drops his pants while he thinks she's sleeping. And basically, and again, penalties in advance, but this is what came out in court, basically dropped his junk on her face for like, you know, X amount of Mississippi and just left it there. And I remember her saying that and there's the look of horror on her face. And I remember looking over at Raniere just thinking like, are you kidding me? The other one, and this is not quite as, I don't want to say it's any less appalling, but it's lighter, I guess, in some ways, in some ways maybe. So there's testimony about Das and the food habits. And I believe it was Lauren. I could be wrong. I think it was Lauren who testified this. And if I'm wrong, I apologize. It, you know, might have been one of the other witnesses. So there's testimony about the eating, you know, rules and, you know, what you can eat and can't eat. So it comes out that Keith tells them they can't have anything to eat, puts a pie in the refrigerator, like apple pie or something, and then puts a camera up there. So when these women have to have, like, you know, 500 calories or less a day, this guy is putting like pie, like right there, and puts a camera. And eventually one of them goes in and, you know, has a slice. Keith runs down and starts going oink, 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 and making the oinky, oinky noise after they did it. And I just remember the way the testimony came out. I'm looking over at him and it just was like, are you like, did you really do that? Like, what kind of a human being does this? You know, this sort of sadistic. And, you know, and meanwhile, it came out that he's going to volleyball and they're showering him with chocolates and kisses. It's not like Keith was, you know, based on everything we saw, and I'm not one to talk myself here as far as I'm not the healthiest eater in the world, but I think it's suffice to say Keith was not having less than 500 calories a day.
He was pudgy.
I know you haven't heard our episode with Karen and our audience has, but I will just tell you there's another story in addition to that, where she shares that she and Keith set up the camera and then watched the footage together and saw Pam Kafritz eating the cake. She called it cake. And then making out with Mariana on camera, which then turned Keith on. And then he went and had a threesome with them and left Karen in the living room. So there's an addition to the story.
Yeah, there was a lot of testimony about Keith and threesomes and yeah, that, and I'm definitely want to listen to Karen's podcast for sure, what she was on.
It's wild.
There's a really appalling instance. Daniela testifies about coming back, and I think it's when she got back from Canada, and Keith basically, I don't want to say a threesome, because I don't know that she partook with this other person, but basically he has her and her sister together. And I remember she testifies and then she says, that was Christmas. And it's just like, you know, the horror of this situation. I'll tell you the testimony of Daniela talking about trying to get out. The fact that she was in the room, the conversation about her dental problems, you know, the medical issues that were not being met. The letters she wrote, where she's writing in caps, what the hell is wrong with you people? I mean, it's clear, you know, this is not something this woman's making up. And then she talks about making it up Route 9 at one point, like near the Walmart, nearly making it out, and then goes back. This person has nowhere she can go. And I think part of the problem is that Keith set things up in a way so that I think he would, I don't think he ever thought he would get caught. I don't think you make videos of yourself and take the steps you take if you really think you're going to get caught. And to be honest, there was no reason, given the fact that we, the TU, had written a huge series of articles on Nexium and Keith Raniere, including the fact that he had alleged sexual encounters with underage girls, which, you know, by the way, and I'm not trying to pick on someone who's, you know, still serving time here, but, you know, Nancy Salzman during The Vow in the second season talks about how, oh my God, we didn't know about this, or at least gives that impression. Well, this was all covered. I mean, right. So this was known. And it's not like she's a lower ranking member. And a lot of people have told me when they were in Nexium, you know, they told us not to read you guys, whatever. And I think for a lower ranking member, I could kind of understand that you're being told what to do, but Nancy was the president. So, you know, she knew damn well what was in those articles.
Hey there, listener. Hope you're enjoying this episode and that you're taking deep breaths when we cover the enraging stuff that cult jerks are up to. Let it out, as in the yoga practice. Inhale positivity, exhale negativity. That's for you, Sarah. We got this. No hulking it out, all you little hulksters. And if you need some helpful resources on the topic of cult recovery, check out our website at alittlebitculty.com. And now, here's a brief message from our sponsors.
I was so deeply disturbed by the trial. Like, I was deeply disturbed. I mean, I was deeply disturbed by everything. I mean,
so
I think it really fucked me up. I mean, I went a lot. It's like a mile from where I live. I was like, you know, I got to see what's happening here, right? And the fact that there was no video and there was no audio in the courthouse, I mean, you know, I went from thinking, like, you probably have seen the transcripts or whatever of that when Claire was arraigned and the judge went off on her, right? For the $100 million bail. And like, what is wrong with you? You know, like, what is wrong with you? And I mean, it's so fascinating just because, like, she's from this prominent, you know, big Jewish family. And in New York, these things matter, right? That's a very key thing to say, I think. Like, these things matter, whatever. But, like, these things matter. And, like, people reached out to me after the article and they were like, you're joking me that this is the Bronfman girl. Like, what? You know, like, these are pillars of the temple. Like, what is happening? And so I went from seeing Claire be arraigned and being like, oh, my God, like, this is real. These people are going to prison. Like, there is no question. Everybody is burning, you know, like, and the idea that you're all standing by Keith, anybody connected to Keith is going to burn, right? And then, but having it as the trial played out, reveal more and more of, like, Keith's utter and complete madness, you know, and the women who took the stand. I mean, again, I would say the women who took the stand were shockingly, like, articulate and just telling an incredible story. And, like, it goes back to this idea that you guys talk about all the time, which is, like, who can be in a cult? Like, who gets in a cult? Because you have this idea that it's just, like, brain dead people, right? But it's not. And, you know, I don't know. It was just, it was, I found it to be, like, one of the most disturbing, like, I had complete insomnia during that trial. I was just totally freaked out. Yeah. And I mean, I'm like, freaked out these people are in the world, you know? Like, I just freaked out by the whole thing.
Yeah, us too. It's so
dark. At the same time, I want, you know, some of them to have another life, right? Like, I mean, I feel both ways. I mean, I want some of them to have another life.
I totally do. I totally do.
For sure, Keith needs to stay in prison for the rest of his life. Part of this whole thing of why, like, when Mara reached out, I was like, yes, of course. And she was saying that you weren't sure, like, how we feel about you. And I just want you to know, and I meant to say this at the beginning, I think I did, actually, like, no hard feelings. Because for us, like, anyone who goes, oh, shit, like, this is bad, then we're fine with. Like, we're all on the same page. Right. Like, but there was a time.
We're informing people.
But there was a time, as you know, that we didn't trust you. And I just wanted to tell this backstory because I think it's interesting how it all played out. Like, and a lot of our fan base are survivors, and a lot of them are just Nexium nerds. We call them Nexium nerds. They're, like, obsessed with this story and they want to know all the details. And I just think this part of history is so wild because, you know, as you know, the New York Times came out and I was on the cover. And then we had heard, because we had friends still on the inside who were kind of playing both sides, right? And they were like, they're going to do a counterpiece. We were told that they were hiring you.
That's so crazy.
And I was like, I don't think they can do that.
Yeah.
But that was sort of like how it was being pitched. Like, they were curating the story. So we knew that this was happening. We knew that. And my memory is fuzzy because it's 5 years ago and we were in trauma. So Nippy, correct me if I'm getting something wrong here. Like, jump in anytime.
But I was in trauma too. So.
She was in trauma more.
So, well, maybe a little bit. We went in and out of different amounts. So we heard that you were writing the story and then we didn't know who it was. And then I guess through my PR, like, I had to hire a PR team because I was getting so many requests and, like, I didn't know how to handle it. And, you know, like, Dateline and Inside Edition and Dr. Oz and 2020, like, it was, everybody wanted to talk. So I hired a PR team and they brought me to you and I think they kind of vetted you. But there was this whole internal, like, on, we call them team takedown. The people who were out, we weren't on the same page because they, I believe you wanted to speak to us, like Mark and Bonnie and Nippy and I. And I think, oh God, what happened? The first time we connected, or was it the first time you connected with Mark? I don't remember, but there was something.
I think I talked to Mark.
Right.
Yeah.
And the conversation you had with him led us all to believe that you had already been indoctrinated and that you were, like, brought into the fold and you were drinking the Kool-Aid. And so they didn't trust you. And this is where we didn't have the same approach. I remember thinking, well, if she's drinking the Kool-Aid and she bought into the whole, you know, consenting adults narrative, then we need to tell her our side of the story, right? And fill you in.
Right. Well, what happened from my, again, like, it's a little fuzzy for me as well, but from my perspective, I got everything I needed from Nexium. So I said, okay, great. Now I'll talk to the defectors. Now, I didn't think you guys were going to be hard to talk to because I just assumed, well, these people want to talk to everybody because they're trying to get the word out and they seem to be talking to everybody. So I don't think this is going to be a problem, right? And again, I think that's, looking back on it, that was naive, right? So I believe, reached out to Mark and I got on the phone, but I was also wary of what could be put on the Frank Report or something else of what I would say. Because again, like I got what I needed from Nexium, but we still needed to like, you know, fact check the thing. We needed to finish the thing, blah, 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 blah. Like the best tactic for me was to have both sides talking to me and then put my piece out. And that would be when Nexium found out what I thought, right? And so I talked to Mark. I mean, my recollection of it, and Mark may have a different one, is that he asked me who I had talked to, and I said, Lauren. And he was like, whoa, what?
I remember. You know? I remember now.
That's probably the one person that you could have said that would have struck the fear of, because she spends a good
right,
one.
Right, right, right. Because she's smart. Smart one. Yeah, yeah, that was clear.
She's super smart.
Well, I'll also say this. She did a very, very good job
at normalizing
the abusive stuff, because she had been in it for so long. So she really didn't believe it was bad. Right.
And she's cool. Yeah. Like we pictured you and her hitting it off. And we were like, oh, fuck. And now I remember.
And
I remember
her subtly dropping comments about our character.
I remember what it was now. You guys spoke. And Mark, even though we were all on the same side, like there was still a bit of the ranking system. Like Mark was above, a little, at least for me. Like he's leading the charge.
He thought he won one way and you thought otherwise.
We disagreed, which is one of the first times that had happened since leaving. But I remember now. So before you and I spoke, and you guys had that conversation and you said that you spoke to Lauren, and he was like, whoa. In that whole time frame, Bonnie found on the Frank Report someone to take and snap. Right. Do you remember this? Taking pictures.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's right.
The summit at Apropos. And she like saw someone she didn't recognize in the crowd. Right. And it was you. And she figured out it was you. And then she was like, oh my God, she's in there. She's infiltrated. Right. She's like.
Yeah.
I thought that as well, though.
Well, we all did.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck this. I'm not having the conversation under their terms.
So like, because you were now an enemy, right? But the difference was, is that I was still like, I'm going to talk to her.
We still have the truth.
Because I know that I have the truth. And I know that if they're going to head fuck Vanessa and she's going to buy in because Lauren's so cool and hip and like whatever, like branding, blah, 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 you know, then then I have to tell you. And so we did, but we did it off the record.
And it was a huge turning point. I mean, for me, I mean,
Good.
So, and what had happened was I said, I think to Mark, let me send you. I mean, also, it just was hard for me to understand. I was like, are you guys not reading what I write? Like, I've written hundreds of articles that are like not like positive on a lot of different stuff, you know? But I sent the article that I had written about Landmark to Mark without really looking at it again. And then when I went and looked at it, I was like, oh my God, there's like 10 quotes in here from Chuck Palahniuk. And like, if that's how you pronounce his last name, like from the Fight Club writer and all these other people saying how great Landmark Forum is. And that story was about like, I attended Landmark and went on the subway after one of the sessions. And I saw one of the guys who was in there and he was a refugee from Africa. And a woman who had met him, you know, on the subway, actually, I think, had like just walked up to him on the subway and said, do you want to change your life? Like, I'll pay for you to go to Landmark Forum. And so he was sitting there and then I saw him on the subway and he and I started this whole conversation. And it was really this like interesting question of like, do you want to change your life? I mean, this guy is like living as like a Shabbos goy and like he has nothing. And like, he's not looking at his personal growth. He's just trying to like day to day, like feed himself, you know? So the question of Landmark and like, what are you really getting and who is it catering to and how deep are the questions they're really asking was like very much part of that story. But I did what I normally do, which is I try to like, you know, do sweet and sour, right? Because I think that's much more effective. Like in a lot of storytelling, you know, you want the suspense. I mean, look at even the way the Vow season one is constructed. Like the whole thing. I mean, what I was amazed by is those first couple of episodes of the Vow. I was like, this feels like my journey, being like, what is this thing? And they're trying to explain it to you through graphics and through you guys coming in, but it's so incredibly like ornate and complex. And it's like looking at this big, you know, expressionist painting or something. You're like, what is this? So for me, I felt like, okay, well, Mark will, you know, everybody can look at this landmark story and they can see that this is not a positive story. But I wasn't at that point planning to put in like a million incredible quotes like by right. like Lauren, like saying this is the greatest thing ever. I mean, I was going to do some of that, but I wasn't. So anyway, whatever. It basically just like I was there at the Coach Summit. Like they invited me to go. I was extremely happy to be there.
And I'm so glad you did.
The whole situation. And, you know, as I do like in my podcast, I think that one of the big moments where I was just so thoroughly sick of them was during the Coach Summit. I was standing in their like sort of halfway backstage and they had an iron out and an ironing board to like iron
the sash on
the sashes. And in the main room, Allison had a bunch of the Mexicans there and she was like, everybody, we're going to play charades. Like, this is how you play charades. And I was just like, you know what? I'm done. I'm out of here. I can't do this one more minute. Like, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
Like, I can't be in here. Like, this is such a charade, you know?
And we know the feeling.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
Imagine having to sit in that room with those orange chairs and the bad lighting for 12 to 14 hours a day for 8 days.
Right. Yes.
If people think that you can't be indoctrinated or brainwashed, try sitting in apropos in that environment, talking about like, what is the difference between honor and character.
Right.
And
can we at least do some like CrossFit at the same time so we can get in shape, or like you just have to starve ourselves and like run later? Yeah.
I used to leave and like pretend to go pick up Troy or like have a emergency so that I could just go for a walk because I was like losing my mind. So listen, right. I get it.
But then you got on the phone with me. I mean, basically what happens yes. is like there's this sense like, no, they're not talking to you. And I was like,
so we weren't talking to you because Mark had decided that because you said that you were only speaking to Lauren and we knew that that wasn't true, they didn't trust you.
In my mind, it was when he said, first of all, look, a lot of journalists, if somebody says, who are you speaking to? The answer is supposed to be, I can't tell you, but I'm speaking to a lot of people and I'll make sure I'm fair, right? Like that's the answer. But I was like, okay, like, let me tell him. So I said, Lauren, and my recollection was I was like, he was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I was like, well, I better stop right there, you know?
Right. Listen, we all were paranoid for different reasons. I mean, us probably more so. And listen, Nippy and I discussed whether we were to share this with you, but we felt like we needed to come clean. We were so paranoid, especially because we weren't sure if you were a plant or hired, because we thought you might be hired. That was one of the theories. And we said that we weren't going to record our conversation. We did record our conversation.
Ah, okay.
And,
that's all right.
And we didn't show any, we just wanted to tell you because we felt
that's
bad about that because that would be an example of an ethical lie, which we talked about. Right. In the
well, I wasn't playing by anyone's rules.
No, we were
like
fuck you.
Fuck
not you, Claire.
I'm protecting my family. Yeah. I'm going
to
do
it. No, we didn't show it to anybody. It was just to like, in case it was protective. It was in case,
well,
you know.
I mean, to me, the big turning points for me were first of all, talking to you and when you told me about the Grandmasters. Because I didn't know that to that point. And you said, like, well, they call them grandmasters. I was like, this one's a master of the blah, 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 blah. Like, how does this really work? You know? And at that point, I think I had had Keith telling me I had, you know, I had sex with one, maybe two people who are in DOS. Like, I don't really, you know, I know them. I mean, I'm more intimate, but it's not sexual and like blah, 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 blah. And I just remember you like laying that out and you were like, oh, honey, this is not like this is. I mean, I probably didn't say to you like, I don't understand. But like, that's what was going on. I was like, I don't really understand and can't accuse this man of sex crimes unless I'm sure. Remember, this was all like pre-indictment, right?
Right.
So talking to you was a big, like,
I'm so happy to hear that
for me, because I had talked to Rick Ross. But, you know, Rick Ross is like Rick Ross's role in this whole cult scene is so fascinating to me, and like who pays his bills and how that all works. And his role is just to be like a spear, right? Just to say like, this is really bad. Everybody listen to this, pay attention over here. So it was like, okay, well, you know, fine. You were involved also in this major lawsuit, but like, I need to get closer in. And the other person who I think felt burned by my story because I didn't use that much of her, unfortunately, and the part that we used was maybe not the part she wanted to, was Barbara Boucher.
Barbara.
Who was incredibly helpful to me.
Yeah.
Like, incredibly helpful. And I feel bad that that happened. And it's like one of those things that happens like when you're closing a piece, blah, 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 you know? But like the two of you that I felt were leveling with me, that were trustworthy, that were smart, and could explain like why this fakakta philosophy was not like.
Do you know what fakakta
like,
means?
How am I like dumb? Like, why don't I understand this philosophy? You know, like, no, it makes no sense. Like, that was helpful.
This podcast is brought to you by Citizens of Sound, a podcast production agency committed to developing and launching shows with gravity and depth. From conception to launch, Citizens will partner with you every step of the way, whether you're an actor, business owner, doctor, fitness coach, hairstylist, or influencer. Connection is the future of communication. Jump on board with Citizens of Sound today and start your show. Go to citizensofsound.com and follow them on Instagram. And trust me, it'll be a really good decision for you.
Wow, justice. All that talk of convictions and prison sentence has me, I don't know, what's the word, feeling vindicated.
We hope you liked it, dear listeners. We will be back soon with all new episodes. And in the meantime, check us out on Patreon. That's patreon.com/alittlebitculty, dropping new episodes every week. And just a reminder, if you join the Inner Circle and you're one of the first 30 people to do so, you will be getting a very special A Little Bit Culty pencil set to go along with the regular merch, which is a signed copy of my book, a hat, some treats from our sponsors, and maybe even some lip balm that says A Little Bit Culty. Can't afford not to join, really. And as you know, if you want to learn more about Nexium's Rise and Fall, you can always go stream both seasons of The Vow on Max, the streamer formerly known as HBO. In case you've never seen it, it's a wild ride. Until next time, don't jaywalk, don't forget to take a multivitamin, and definitely don't join a cult. See you next time. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Hope you liked this episode. Let's keep the conversation going and come hang out with us on Patreon, where we keep the tape rolling each week with special episodes just for Patreon subscribers and where we get deep into the weeds of unpacking every episode of The Vow.
And if you're looking for our show notes or some sweet, sweet swag or official ALBC podcast merch or a list of our most recommended cult recovery resources, visit our website at alittlebitculty.com.
And for more background on what brought us here, check out Sarah's page-turning memoir. It's called Scarred: True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life. It's available on Amazon, Audible, narrated by my wife, and at most bookstores.
A Little Bit Culty is a Talkhouse podcast and a Trace 120 production. We're executive produced by Sarah Edmondson and Anthony Nippy Ames, with writing, research, and additional production support by senior producer Jess Tardy. We're edited, mixed, and mastered by our rocking producer, Will Rutherford of Citizens of Sound. And our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Aslan. Thank you for listening.